Yeah, thanks very much for that, Tom. Okay, well, I'm going to start with explanations for the crisis that aren't Marxist. In fact, I'm going to start with not only non-Marxist explanations, but non-Marxist explanations for a crisis that's not this one. Yeah, just to be really off the topic. But I want to go back to the Great Depression because in terms of explanations, I think that there are, you know, it's a sign of the weakness, I think, of non-Marxist economics generally in terms of being able to come to terms with something that is so fundamental to the life of capitalism, and that is the fact that it periodically goes into horrible slumps. Ben Bernanke, who you will know as the head of the US Federal Reserve, is also, I was happy to discover via the British Marxist Chris Harman, Ben Bernanke is also meant to be one of the mainstream experts on the Great Depression. And this is what he has to say about explaining why capitalism went into crisis at that point. He calls the explanation the holy grail of economics, something sought after but never found. He's the big expert on it. There have been various attempts at explanation. I'm not going to go through them in chapter and verse, but the most widely accepted version, I think, is that workers had priced themselves out of their jobs by not accepting cuts in their money wages. There are various other explanations to do with the credit system. Friedrich von Hayek and the Austrian School of Economists, for example, argued that excess credit in the early 1920s had led to a disproportionately high level of investment, which only the slump itself could overcome. And probably the person I should spend a bit more time on, because he's had such a revival of late with the current crisis, is, of course, John Maynard Keynes. He saw an excess of saving over investment as leading to a lack of what he called effective demand for the economy's output. He said that this arose from underconsumption. That is, the problem is not one of overproduction in terms of what can be sold profitably, the Marxist explanation, which I'll come back to in some detail later, but that of consumers, for one reason or another, backing off and not consuming enough to stimulate investment. Now, there's a real obvious problem, I think, with the underconsumptionist theory of crisis, and that is that it cannot explain why crisis would not be permanent under capitalism, which it clearly isn't. We wouldn't be having these talks about capitalist crisis if it was a constant, long-term, ongoing crisis. If you think about it, if underconsumption is the problem, think about working-class people. Where do the bosses get their profits from? Actually, how can we possibly consume all of that which we produce as the working class? They don't pay us the full value of what we produce. That's where their profits come from. And even apart from that, there's whole areas of the economy, the production of what you call producer goods, of the means of production, well, workers don't consume any of those, you know, electricity turbines or whatever. So there is, you know, the whole point of the restricted consumption of the working class is just a normal condition of capital accumulation. And so this can't really be an explanation for why there are periodic crises. I think that the lack of effective demand in Keynes's theory of crisis is really another way of saying that capital is not being invested. And that's true. But it doesn't explain why. It's merely a description of the effects of crisis, not an explanation of why crises take place. So I want to move on to, I think, an explanation that does make sense of this, which is that provided by Marx. And I'll say now, I'm not going to spend the entire talk just going through what Marx has to say, because I think part of what Marxist economics is about is being able to provide a general explanation for how the system works and then relate that to the actual way in which a particular crisis, in this case the one that we're going through right at the moment, how that particular crisis has played out. Because we can't really test the theory unless we actually try and link those two things together. There is a central element in Marx's theory of crisis, and that is what he calls the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. Marx argued that this tendency is a long-term tendency, and it exists alongside the more or less regular boom-slump cycle caused by the lack of coordination of investment decisions through the system. I'll go through this in a little bit of detail. The profitability for capitalism is the key factor that determines level of investment. And again, this is ABC to anyone who's even faintly thought about what a rotten system capitalism is. That we've got all kinds of what you would think was demand, but apparently not effective demand, demand for food by starving people throughout the world and so on. But nothing happens unless there's a profit in it under capitalism. So profitability is the key factor in determining levels of investment. The unplanned nature of capitalist expansion leads to overproduction of capital. They're all trying to get in on the act, get profits while they can, and the production of too many commodities that then can be sold at a profit. Credit comes in here as well. The expansion of credit facilitates the expansion of investment and of the market. But then again, it also contracts when investment has overshot what the market is capable of absorbing. And again, this is a reflection of the anarchy of the market. The inability to sell then means capitalists can't turn surplus value they've extracted from workers into profits, which leads to cuts in investments, to layoffs, and so on. And this is the kind of cyclical crisis of boom and slump that is the normal, you know, roughly every 10 years, but not anywhere near as exact as that, roughly every 10 years, up and down, boom-slump cycle of the way that capitalism operates. But by itself, this would not explain what we're going through now. There's much more. And that much more is built into the very mechanisms of capitalism every day of its life. The incentive to incessantly increase productivity, something that competition compels every capitalist to do, leads to a growing ratio of investment in means of production compared to investment in human labour. That is, more investment in machines and fixed capital in proportion to the number of workers employed. And since workers' labour, as the source of surplus value, is the root of their capitalist profits, the relative decline in the labour component of total investment leads to a decline in the rate of profit. And this is what Marx meant when he talked about the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. The very process of competitive accumulation meant that the part of investment that actually produced new value, that is the investment in human labour power, declined relative to the total investment as the means of production grew ever larger and so on. But there's still something to be said about this, because if this tendency of the rate of profit to fall, which, as I've said, is built into the everyday functioning of the system, if that's the case, again, why don't we just see one long permanent crisis? And Marx has an answer to this as well. He says that there are countervailing factors to this tendency for the ratio of living labour to dead labour, what he sometimes calls the organic composition of capital, the ratio of dead labour to living labour, the organic composition of capital, to rise. And the countervailing factors that he talks about, there's a number of them, and again, some of them will be really obvious to you. One of the ways in which the bosses can keep up their profits is, of course, to make the workers work harder and longer, to increase productivity in agriculture and consumer goods industries, to cut the value of the cost of providing the workers with the living standards they expect. So a series of things driving down the class struggle itself can revive the rate of profit to an extent. But in order to concentrate on, there are a series of other countervailing factors. I'm not going to go through all of them. But most importantly, I think, in the long run, is the role that economic crisis itself can have in restoring the rate of profit and opening up some possibility for the system to perhaps go forward. Because the crisis itself, by driving some firms out of business, enables other firms to buy up their plant and equipment on the cheap. At the same time, the crisis creates unemployment, helps the bosses to force wages down. Again, the various costs that they have, the impediments to profitability, those things can be to some extent, mitigated. The profit rates of those companies that survive the crisis can rise and therefore create the conditions for a new expansion of investment and production. But even this mechanism does not operate in some uniform way over time, because another thing is going on as well, what Marx calls the concentration and centralisation of capital. Very simple, that competition between firms means that big fish eat up smaller fish, that those companies that are the least profitable, the least able to keep up with the competition, for example, in terms of increasing productivity, investing in new labour-saving technology, whatever it is, those firms are taken over by their rivals. The units of capital become ever larger and fewer in number. And that concentration and centralisation due to competition That concentration and centralisation due to competition means that the crisis itself, that mechanism that can actually restore the rates of profit by wiping out certain numbers of capitals, becomes much more damaging to the system as a whole. The size of the units of capital is so great that to let the crisis rip actually risks much more fundamental to the damage, much more fundamental damage to the system in terms of who knows what will be dragged down if we let these ones go. And we've seen this actually just last year, that Lehman Brothers was allowed to go bankrupt. And then what happened? They got a fright. That the idea, at first, that, well, yes, this will show us, you know, that things can actually be cleaned out in this way. It wasn't the beginning of letting the crisis rip. It was the beginning of saying, we can't have this happen. We don't know where everything is linked to everything else. It could drag down far more of the world's, at that stage, financial system than any capitalist was prepared, any capitalists and their governments were prepared to risk. And so the result of this concentration and centralisation of capital and the effect that this has on the crisis means that recessions over time tend to get deeper as the system gets older. And I think we're very much in a crisis of that kind at this moment. So that's a very brief account of Marx's arguments for the cause of crisis. But I want to try and move on to the present crisis. We look at 21st century capitalism, and particularly I'm focusing on the United States because it's the biggest of the capitalist powers, obviously. 21st century capitalism was faced with a rate of profit lower than what it had been at the high points of the great post-war boom three decades earlier. However, these things don't, as I say, they don't go along in some sort of general, uniform, slow progression. In the 21st century, US capitalism in particular had succeeded in reducing the share of wages in national income and preventing a total collapse of profitability. This had been sufficient to produce a certain, although rapidly fluctuating, level of productive investment, but it was a level of productive investment that was not on a sufficient scale to absorb all of the surplus value that had been produced in previous rounds of production. The gap between saving and investment that would otherwise have led to recessionary pressures had been filled, though, in the early part of the 21st century by unproductive investment and speculative spending. The point was inevitably reached where the speculative elements involved in the boom couldn't be sustained and its underlying weaknesses suddenly came to the fore with devastating effect. Now, what I've said so far, even though I've said it about 21st century capitalism, could also have been said of the Great Depression. But just because all crises are crises of capitalism doesn't mean all crises are the same. And there are a couple of, I think, very important differences. The crisis this time to the crisis of the Great Depression. The first of these is the extent of state expenditure. State expenditure has for nearly 70 years been central to the system in a way in which it was not in 1929. In that year, US federal government expenditures represented only 2.5% of GNP. In 2007, federal expenditure was around 20% of GNP. So we've got a much higher level of state expenditure as the norm of the system these days. The second difference from the Great Depression to now has been the speed and vigour with which the government has moved to intervene in the economy. It's been much greater this time than it was in the 1920s, 1930s. And these things have some consequences. The increased importance of state expenditures and the willingness of central banks and governments to spend rapidly in order to try to cope with the crisis means that there is a base level of demand in the economy, which provides a floor, at least at this point, who knows what will happen in the future, a floor below which the economy is not likely to sink. Again, this was not at all the case in the early 1930s. And in this situation, particularly its military expenditures, we're talking about $800 billion, twice the level in current dollars today of what it was even as recently as 2001. And so military expenditure plays a particularly important role in guaranteeing markets to a core group of very important corporations. And such spending can clearly serve to mitigate the impact of the crisis, even though it can't avert it. But there is another important difference that operates in the opposite direction. Those differences appear to be ones that can kind of stop the crisis being as devastating, perhaps, as it was in the 1930s. Not that I'm guaranteeing any of that. But there is an important second difference that operates in the opposite direction. And that is that the major financial and industrial corporations, as I mentioned earlier, operate on a much greater scale than in the interwar years in the 1930s. And therefore, the strain on governments of bailing them out is disproportionately larger. And I think this time we've seen a crisis in many of the biggest banks in most major economies. So how can they do this? Well, actually, if they're going to restore the profitability of the banks, they've got to get the value from somewhere. Restoring the profitability of the banks can only be done by eventually extracting real value from elsewhere in the economy, either from other profitable bits of the system or by cutting into the living standards of workers in ways that themselves can have a recessionary impact. It might just be possible for a state with an economy as big as that of the US to do this, but, of course, the US is not the only economy in the world. It is going to be much harder for weaker states with smaller economies and proportionally bigger debts to be able to do this. And I think you look at the problems facing a series of countries like Iceland or Hungary or Latvia, they're an indication of this. Their governments and the IMF, which is supposedly helping them, have turned to measures of the good old neoliberal kind, cutting state expenditure, raising interest rates and so on, rather than any of the sort of state-sponsored bailouts that have been the way that's been taking place in the US. But even with the US, this idea that the state can somehow hold off the worst effects of the crisis, stop a total slump happening, their experience of Japan in the 1990s, I think, provides a warning as to the limits of what government action can achieve in even the biggest economies. I don't have time to go through here in any detail what the Japanese government did. Suffice it to say that there was a massive amount of state investment and expenditure to try and stop the economy totally falling through the floor. And really, what that experience seems to indicate is that the maximum that state intervention, short of a massive encroachment on private capital by the state, you know, it's sort of really a return to state capitalism, the maximum that state intervention may be able to achieve is to prevent a complete collapse. But it can't by itself overcome the fundamental imbalance caused by, you guessed it, the low profit rates. And there's a warning from Japan, I think, in all this. A decade and a half of paralysis, think what happened to the Japanese economy. A decade and a half of paralysis for the Japanese economy, which is all that massive state intervention was able to produce, meant devastation for Japan. But it didn't mean devastation for the rest of the world. Think now of the effect of a similar period of paralysis in the US and the effect that that would have be felt everywhere and not only in economic terms, because US-based capital would use the might of the American state and its still dominant role in the world financial system to try and offload the costs of the crisis onto weaker parts of the system. So the solution is really not a solution at all. So, is this the crisis of neoliberalism? Well, I'm kind of inclined to leave that open because I think there's a series of discussions that comrades have had in, I think, other sessions as well about neoliberalism, what do we actually mean by neoliberalism? But I think there are a few things we can say. As we've seen, the capitalist class looked into the void of bankruptcy, and when they saw that, free market ideology was unceremoniously ditched and government intervention and even nationalisation was once again promoted as the way to save capitalism. But this didn't mean that they gave up on wage cuts or a tax on non-corporate welfare. They were very keen on corporate welfare, but at the same time, welfare itself was in many countries still undermined. The form of the current crisis, I think, is a consequence of the contradictions that are inherent in the neoliberal agenda. Because the whole idea of neoliberalism always is full of contradictions. And we can see how this has played out over particularly the US economy, over the last few decades. You think about what we generally think as being meant by neoliberalism. Free markets, small government. They're often thought of as the hallmarks of neoliberalism. But there's also things like tax cuts for the rich, economic deregulation, privatisation. And the idea that the riches that by these measures ended up in the pockets of the wealthy were supposed to trickle down to everyone else. But the other side of this ruling class strategy was also relentless attacks on working class conditions in order to try and once again boost profit rates. And there are inbuilt contradictions in all of this. Think about the free market reforms in the US during the 1980s. They couldn't stop the second financial crisis since the early 20th century, the first one being the crash of 1929 that led to the Great Depression. The second financial crisis of the 20th century was not the one we're going through now, it's the one that people have largely forgotten, and that was what was known as the savings and loans crisis. The savings and loans banks are kind of building societies, I guess, in Australian terms. Originally offered low-interest savings accounts from which they financed mortgages. Sound a bit familiar, perhaps. Deregulation of the industry led to them increasingly speculating in property and taking other risks because they were allowed to. By 1983, 35% of America's savings and loans weren't profitable, 9% of them were technically bankrupt. And the US government was, guess what, forced to step in and bail them out to the tune of $124 billion, which seems like small beer now, but quite significant at the time. And you think, quite contrary to all of this idea of free markets and small government and privatisation and no state intervention. The government's use of taxpayers' money staved off a wider crisis, but it was a sign of things that would come. And the socialisation of banking losses using taxpayers' money signalled that the free market, as we have subsequently seen once again, is only embraced when there are profits to be made. So again, we come back to the question of profits. As soon as the capitalists suffer big losses, they demand that the state fund them. Now, the savings and loan crisis, and I think this is one of the reasons why it's largely been forgotten, seemed like a bit of a glitch, that the system seemed to be going on, you know, that this was, okay, a bad thing that happened, the state stepped in, fixed it up, and so on. But more of the economic precepts of neoliberalism continued to store up future problems. Increasingly, banks no longer had to have capital reserves to cover their loans if they turned bad. Further deregulation led to investment banks packaging up debts and selling them. Bond rating agencies such as Moody's and Standard & Poor's, you know, I don't know if they do this in other states, but in New South Wales, the government's really keen to go on about, we've got to hold on to our AAA rating. Do they do that down here?
In Queensland.
They're all keen. Oh, yeah. Queensland's lost theirs. Bad luck. Obviously didn't pay the bribe. Because how do the ratings agencies work? They're not some independent arbiter. They get paid money by the people they rate. That's how you get a AAA rating. So all of this, but the AAA rating obviously then helps you to continue to make loans, sell off, sell bonds and so on. And so to provide AAA ratings so that pension funds and insurance companies would buy up the bundles of debt, all you had to do was to bribe the ratings agencies. And all this seemed to work for a while. In the 1990s, the US economy grew strongly, but this delivered basically nothing to the working class of the United States. And so to maintain their living standards, workers had to do a number of things. They had to work longer hours, and more households depended on more than one wage. Even so, total household earnings were lower in 2007 than they had been a decade earlier. And so people were caught in a spiral into debt as workers took advantage of cheap credit to make up for falling income. So the bosses said, well, fine, we can't, you know, we're not going to pay you, your unions have been weakened, you're going to have to put up with falling real wages, but don't worry, there's cheap credit. Just borrow to fund the living standard that you had a decade earlier. As the American Marxist Joel Geyer summed up the outcome of all of this, the principal reason for the explosion of bad consumer debt is the enormous class inequalities fueled by neoliberal free market union busting policies. That's quite a good summary. But to continue our story, after a crisis that swept Asia in 1998 and then the recession in the US in 2000-2001, interest rates were cut further to 1-2% in many of the most advanced industrial countries. Cheap credit was seen to be the answer, but of course it didn't address the underlying problem. It couldn't solve the underlying ill health of the profit rate. What it did do was to fuel the biggest housing bubble in history. 34 million US households, nearly a third of the US population, borrowed against their homes. And this could be sustained as long as house prices were rising. When they began to falter in 2007, then millions found that they couldn't refinance, they couldn't afford their mortgages, and were forced to walk away from their homes. But there was more to the 2008 financial crisis than workers' mortgages. Mortgage lenders had bundled up mortgages that were likely to fail and sold them on. They sold them as bonds to cash in on the speculative boom. There was capital seeking a place to invest. The rate of profit was not high enough for them to think, yeah, let's invest and make more cars, whatever. And so the reason that these toxic debts got taken up was, again, related back to the level of the rate of profit. And the recurring reselling of these bundles of debt was the basis for what became known as the toxic debt that brought down all the major lenders in the US financial system and sparked the crisis. So the final thing I want to talk about, is this question of the financial crisis, because I began by talking about some of the explanations or lack of explanations that have been brought up by non-Marxist economists for the Great Depression. If we were to look for the non-Marxist explanation for the current crisis, I think we could sum it up in the words financial crisis. In fact, there was for a whole period, I know on the ABC radio, they've got this sort of drive time show, and they were talking for ages about the GFS as if everyone would know what it was. The GFS? Great Financial Crisis. Global Financial Crisis. That it became this sort of, everyone knows what this is. And therefore, I want to finish by just saying that I think it's totally wrong to see this as just a financial crisis. Neither should we see it as either it's a financial crisis or it's a crisis of profitability. Actually, the two things are not counterposed but linked, because it's the underlying rate of profit that fueled the speculation in financial instruments and so on in the first place. US officials tried to downplay the effect the financial crisis would have on the so-called real economy, where commodities are produced, when the thing first broke out. But they were denying reality. The things are linked. Think about it. Since the Asian crisis of 1998, the US has become the buyer of last resort, importing cheap Asian goods, particularly from China, on an ever-increasing scale. The US also had a huge trade deficit, paid for by 80% of world savings. In the recovery after the 2001 recession, American corporations did not invest in new factories and equipment in the US. American capital flowed into China and, of course, into the speculative investment bubbles that I spoke of before. But American capital flowed into China to produce goods to export back to the US, where they were bought by workers, increasingly depending on debt to make up for their falling wages in order to buy them. This debt, in turn, was financed by China. And yet, when the financial crisis hit, there was a sudden desire to deny how integrated the world economy was. This was one of their principal arguments to convince workers in the developed world that if they wanted jobs, they had to accept third world wages, because it was all globalised now and that's just how it was. Suddenly, a new word sprang into use, decoupled. The US crisis would be quarantined. Australia was immune because it sold minerals to China, which was enjoying an endless boom. But now, of course, all that's gone by the by. World recession is now the agreed prognosis. So to conclude, the Great Recession demonstrates that the capitalist system is racked by contradictions that can't be overcome. Economic booms are always followed by bust. No matter how much wealth is created in the system, it can't satisfy human need, because profits and the continued rule of capital are the determining factors as long as this system continues. The central thing we need to understand is that the crisis is not simply a fault of a lack of financial regulation. It's not simply about bankers' greed. It's systemic. The major units of capital have become too big for the system to emerge from crisis through market mechanisms. That is why states have had to intervene, even if their intervention creates new problems and with them political and ideological turmoil. And it's to that I think we should conclude. Neoliberal ideas, the things that are now in that political and ideological turmoil, neoliberal ideas never appealed to most workers. Why would they? Their acceptance was very much of the Tina kind. There is no alternative, that acronym. And as the crisis works through, the defeat of neoliberalism can create major opportunities for socialists. Understanding the cause of capitalist crisis as central to the functioning of the system is part of arming ourselves to take up those opportunities.